Thank you all for coming tonight. This is it's a great turnout for a cold April Friday. I don't understand, but I'm not going to be talking about climate today. I'm going to be talking about disasters. The title of my talk, of course, is Landslides, Volcanoes, and Wildfires, Views from Above. And as so nicely introduced, looking at the Earth from above is going to be very different from what you might see on the ground. So I don't know if anybody here has experienced a hazard or a major disaster before, but this is totally a different way of looking at things. So let's see what we got here. So I did want to show you an image from Google Earth, but without an internet connection, we're going to use this image here that I borrowed from GOI. It's a view of Manhattan from April 16th, 2006, and we are, where are we? Somewhere around here, right? Oh no, we're further north. We're somewhere around here where all the big buildings are. So all of you are probably very familiar at this point with Google Earth and taking a look at these major satellite snapshots of different parts of the United States and other countries. And what we're seeing is just that, a daily snapshot, no clouds, it's not nighttime, and we're lucky if it's been updated to include the new building that was put up, say, across from the hospital 3 months ago. So this is something just from last year. It's high resolution, it's very beautiful, and it can be extremely useful depending on your needs. Now, if you need to take a look at something at night, no luck, especially if everyone turned off the lights. So let's say this is Manhattan, the day of the big blackout a couple years ago. If you need to look at something when it's cloudy, sorry. If any of you have flown in over LaGuardia or Kennedy and looked out on a really gray day and tried to figure out where is home, sometimes you can't do it because it can be pretty darn cloudy. And that's exactly what could happen to you if you have some real needs to see what's happening on the ground, which is exactly what happens when you need timely information from such things as landslides, volcanoes, and wildfires. So that's what I'm going to be talking to you about, are these specific type of hazards. But you can extend this analysis to just about any kind of hazard that changes the way the surface looks, which is kind of what the definition of a hazard is in some people's understanding. So to give you an idea of a specific hazard that wreaked a good amount of havoc. This is the largest landslide of the Chichi earthquake right here. The Chichi earthquake occurred in, I know I'm pronouncing that wrong and I'm sorry, I think it's Chichi earthquake, September 20th, 1999. It was a magnitude 7.6, extremely large, and it occurred at 1:47 a.m. local time. So it's dark out, everyone's asleep, most people are asleep. What happened afterwards, over the course of several weeks, there were severe aftershocks. Some of them are in the high sixes. Up to 10,000 landslides were produced. Approximately 2,400 people were killed. So these numbers are always approximate because oftentimes people can't tell whether or not it was specifically because of the hazard, the major disaster, or because of some secondary effect. Communities in the Central Mountain Range were isolated. So here's the Central Mountain Range. The star is the location of the earthquake. This, this sawtooth symbol represents the rupture area. So the fault that ruptured and the area that was affected. And right here is the location of this largest landslide right here. And it did happen in monsoon season, which could be a really big problem if you've taken away all the vegetation and then rain on it. You can expect mudslides on top of your already damaging landslides. So this is a big deal. And I'm going to get into this particular case study a little bit later. As you can see, here's a view from above. This is actually an aerial photo of the Tsawling landslide, which is on the order of kilometers. So it's a huge, huge landslide, and this is just someone's drawing of what was actually happening there. In terms of what the surface cover remained after the event. Okay, so that's one specific earthquake. And please feel free to interrupt me anytime if you have any questions about specific events, because I will go through some of these cases pretty quickly. So as I mentioned before, you do need to do a certain number of things in the event of a disaster. You've all probably thought about, you've all probably thought about preparedness, mitigation, relief, recovery. In general, the kind of preparation that I'm going to be talking about are going to be the relief and recovery phase. So how exactly can you harness remote sensing technology to deal with disasters from the standpoint of relief and recovery? Because this is all images and views from above after the event has actually happened. And we'll talk a little bit about how we can improve preparedness using remote sensing. So I've mentioned this word remote sensing a bunch of times. I've assumed everybody's taken a look at Google Earth and thought that, oh, look, that's remote sensing. But that is exactly what remote sensing is. It's looking at things remotely, not being directly in contact with it. So right now I am not remote sensing the podium. I am in contact with the podium. Everything else you can consider remote sensing. You're using your eyes. Yeah. But this remote sensing generally deals with airborne, satellite, or autonomous vehicles, so unmanned vehicles like Predator. And then after I go into the definition of remote sensing, I'll talk a little bit about my specific research area, which is using radar to take a look at disasters and resurfacing. And then we'll go more into radar disaster mapping. And then I'll look in more depth at the results from the Chichi earthquake in Taiwan, the Madon volcano eruption in Papua New Guinea, and the Rodeo Chudzinski wildfire in Arizona, USA. So, remote sensing, definition. This is a definition I really like. It's from the Canadian Remote Sensing, Canadian Center for Remote Sensing up in Canada. And a lot of these cartoons I'm using that are from this CCRS, because they have a really great online tutorial if you want to take a look at it of radar remote sensing. They have some excellent satellites, actually an excellent satellite that's been in operation since the 90s, and they're going to update it soon. But we'll talk about that again later, of course. So here we go with what is remote sensing? So I'm going to read the slide. Remote sensing is the science, and to some extent the art, of acquiring information about the Earth's surface without actually being in contact with it. It's done by sensing and recording reflected or emitted energy and processing, analyzing, and applying that information. So what you can see here in this schematic is the sun is your energy source, and it's incident upon the Earth's surface. A satellite then has an antenna or a sensor that picks up any of the radiation that's been re-emitted back through the atmosphere, and then relays that information to a ground station, which then sends it up to a communication satellite. At that ground station, you might have some processing. In this case, there's levels F and G are different types of processing. So before you even see an image on Google Earth or see any kind of satellite image, generally it's been through quite a few steps. And of course, all of this requires energy, and that's why I'm just going to touch on the electromagnetic spectrum, since I'm not going to be using the visible. I'm going to be talking a little bit about the longer wavelengths. For remote sensing purposes, some people tend to use the ultraviolet. That's really if you're looking at atmospheric composition, atmospheric effects. It's much shorter wavelength than what you see. Ultraviolet, so violet is the shortest wavelength of visible light. And then we go on to visible light. Visible goes from, you know, good old Roy G. Biv, from violet up to red. And we see it's a very, very small portion of the spectrum. And I'm sure you're going to see that we're going to keep going up to the longer wavelengths. And there's quite a bit of electromagnetic spectrum that we can use for remote sensing. So next, beyond visible, is infrared. And infrared is a good deal longer than visible. It's actually several times the size. This black bar here is several times the size as the visible part of the spectrum, and infrared is often used for vegetation mapping because plants emit a good amount of infrared radiation, and you can tell a lot of information about their growing based on that. And then there's radar. Okay, radar stands for radio detection and ranging, and this deals with the microwave region of the electromagnetic spectrum. So now we've gone through UV, through visible, through infrared, and we're into the microwave region. And what happens in the microwave region is we separate it into bands based on basically the available bandwidth for using energy in I think all this naming convention started in the military, so please don't ask me what they mean. They have some very straight esoteric meanings with military focus. But the bottom line is that we'll be using P-band, L-band, C-band, and X-band. And as you can see, these are wavelengths that are not on the order of nanometers like the visible waves. These are on the order of feet. So the usable microwave range for remote sensing purposes is on the order of inches at X-band and C-band, and then we get into more of the foot length between L and P-band. So keep that in mind, that L and P have to do with longer, and X and C are smaller. And I'll take you through some more background information. And also, if you get confused, I might slip into jargon periodically, so please stop me. One of the things with dealing with military conventions and radar, you start calling everything a target. So if I start calling things target, please stop me. So taking you through the electromagnetic spectrum, talked about things being emitted, and we've looked at definition of remote sensing using the sun for emission. And that's what this is showing you here. It says down here in the bottom, these colors all represent what's emitted by the sun, which is everything from Earth out to down here, and then the Earth. So this is the energy that could be available for us for taking pictures. Okay. And this up here, actually you can call this freely available. Okay. Up here is a representation of the atmosphere and the way that the gases in the atmosphere absorb energy. So down here, of all the UV radiation that's emitted, a good portion of it gets sucked up by the atmosphere and doesn't make it through. Likewise in the infrared range. But the visible, you get quite a lot of bang for your buck. So a lot of it is emitted and a lot of it is transmitted through the atmosphere. However, when you get out here into the longer wavelengths, there's no natural emission. Right? This is all, it's got to be created by something. Right? And it's not created by the sun or the Earth. But if you can figure out a way to emit it, you get a lot of bang for your buck. All right, there's a large band of information that could pass through the atmosphere and make it back to your receiver. So this is where we talk about where the energy comes from, and just to hit home again, you can have energy from the sun, instant on the Earth, and then antennas on your satellite or on your plane grabbing that information, just like your camera would. Or you can have a flash. Just like a camera, you get energy from batteries and flash at the Earth and then receive that energy bounce back towards you to make a picture. And this is what happens with microwave radiation and radar remote sensing. So why exactly would we even consider using this kind of expensive battery system? Well, there's got to be a reason. And military, of course, has been doing it for a long time, and remote sensing, professionals like myself have been very, very enthralled by radar's unique capabilities. So what is it exactly that it does? Well, in terms of disasters, it's pretty great. What happens is, during a disaster, it can happen at any time. So you can have darkness, clouds, or smoke that delay relief efforts. Right, we just saw before what happens with Google Earth when you turn off the lights and you take the clouds and sprinkle them around. So radar actually allows for a detailed characterization of the surface, and it gives you information about how that surface cover might change. Because as I mentioned before, when you're dealing with these wavelengths that are X-band through P-band, you're dealing with things that are on the order of inches to feet. So what radar is doing is it's actually sensing what kind of changes might be occurring on the order of inches to feet right at the surface of the Earth, and sometimes even penetrating down deeper. Is that clear to everybody? Okay, I'll make it a little bit clearer. We'll get into some of the more technical details in a minute. So here's our image of our plane beaming down the information to the surface and beaming back after it's interacted with a house and a tree. And if we were dealing with the short wavelengths or the infrared, we'd be caring a lot about leaf structure, photosynthesis, the amount of moisture in the leaves. We'd worry about the green and the infrared radiation that's coming off of the leaves and the trees. We worry a lot about the blue and the green radiation that's coming off the surface of a lake. But with the microwaves, we're just bouncing these long wavelength bits of energy at the surface and bouncing them off again. And our satellite is detecting them, and here it's detecting what's happening, the bouncing at a corner, and here it's detecting what's happening inside a tree, all that diffuse kind of, it's called scattering. So backscatter, and in this case, it's more of reflection. That's generally what it's called. Now we can go a little bit deeper with radar. So instead of just bouncing the energy off the surface of the Earth, you can actually get information about the directionality of that energy. So again, we're dealing with the same wavelength, but this time we're getting some pretty fancy transmission and reception of waves. So this is called a linear polarization, and this is a standard way of decomposing a wave. So just like you can wear polarized sunglasses that block out some of the radiation from the sun so that you can see things crisper, that's exactly what's happening here. You can transmit waves in a horizontal direction. So if you think about a plane coming at you in a horizontal direction like this, like a snake sliding around, or you can think of taking a jump rope and whipping it up and down. That would be your vertical direction. So you're looking at energy that's in these two different directions. So now you're getting things that occur with dimension in the XY plane, but also you're getting things that occur with dimension in the XZ plane. All right, so now we're getting a little bit more information about what's happening at the surface and from inches to feet. So you see how this is starting to make sense for if you're looking at disasters and changes of the surface cover. Okay, so now go back again to these cartoons of what's happening at the Earth's surface. We can start calling these specific interactions, these geometrical interactions, something more special. Here's the jargon. So you can have interaction with bare surfaces. Specular reflection is like with a mirror. So if you bounce information off the mirror, it bounces right back again. And then Bragg scattering, which is a resonance effect that's happening at the wavelength. So if you're having, like, if you're looking at waves on the surface or a volcanic flow that has hardened, and you can get a type of what's called Bragg scattering. Single and double bounces. The number of times that a wave bounces around, that can be captured by an antenna. So you can figure out if you have a dipole, which is just, think about a pole, like a tree is like a dipole. You can have volume scattering, the branches within the tree or the leaves within the tree, and you can have corner reflection. In an urban environment, you'd see a lot of corners. And of course, you can go even further. I've skipped over the math. If you're interested in the math, I could give you some information on that. You can send me an email. But assuming that the math is all there, I've talked to you a lot about the raw data, so bouncing things around, vertical, horizontal, transmit and receive, and this is all energy that's coming back scattered to you from a pixel. So that actually has a name, it's called a scattering vector. And then there's a way of getting a little bit deeper into what's happening at the pixel level, and that is called a scattering mechanism. So is your scattering mechanism a bare surface, is it a dipole? You can actually transform that into a mathematical expression and assign colors to it. So I'll show you some pictures in just a little bit with these color composites of these parameters that give you an idea of what a scattering mechanism is. And those scattering mechanisms are going to turn into something real. So that's all very abstract, very interesting, but plain English. You have a road, you have a tree. Here at your road, you see you'll have one single bounce, one scattering mechanism, I called it alpha before, don't worry about that. Low entropy, meaning it doesn't have a lot of disorder. You can actually discern what's happening at the pixel level, scattering around. Or you can have a tree with diffuse bouncing and lots of different scattering mechanisms, and you really can't tell which one is the more dominant, what's really happening. You end up with a high entropy, high disorder, and you can't discern more than that this is a tree. You're not going to be able to say this is a maple that's about to drop its leaves, for example, because it's going to look a whole lot like a pine tree in general. Okay, so that sort of boiled it down to what exactly radar can do, and then we'll talk a little bit about what it can do for a specific type of hazard. So what I've just taken you through quite briefly and very quickly is that we have an analysis that takes a simple transmission and reception of microwaves. Same microwaves that you use to heat up your leftovers. and it turns it into a sensitive and specific tool for examining the landscape. So let's examine the landscape. So now I'm going to bring us back to the Qiqi earthquake in Taiwan and application of radar disaster mapping. So here it is again. This is, again, the Saoling landslide, the largest landslide. There it is just south of the fault, south of the earthquake epicenter. And I'm going to point out some more of the features. You see vegetation in the hills. This is a very rugged terrain, as you can tell by most of Taiwan is rugged, unless you're out on the coastal plain. This here is a slip surface, and this is the debris pile. So vegetation, river. And you can see here that the landslide slid right into a river. So it dammed the river, and it backed up all this water. And of course, after that monsoon that I talked to you about, there was a major concern that that this debris pile would actually breach, and the dam would just come, and the dam would breach, and the debris pile would not be able to hold back all this water, and just cause like a secondary disaster. So a lot of times when you hear about disasters and you hear about fatalities, there's something secondary that has happened. In this case, earthquake, landslide, and then potential for a third. So in 2000, nearly a year after the earthquake, the AIRSAR mission, the AIRSAR instrument as part of the PAC-RIM mission, was flown around the Pacific Rim, and the AIRSAR instrument is a flying laboratory in the Pacific Rim. Everyone knows what the Pacific Rim is, right? Yeah, Pacific Rim is basically the ring of fire around the Pacific, so California, Alaska, all the way around Asia, Australia, Antarctica, back up again on Latin America, South America. Okay, so what we have here is data that was retrieved during that mission. So our remote sensing was this big DC-8 plane with a bunch of antennas loaded on its underbelly, and it flew around the Pacific Rim gathering radar data at three different frequencies, L-band, P-band, and C-band. Unfortunately, just for this particular site, the P-band was very, very noisy. You end up having a lot of interference with radios in the vicinity of whatever kind of like radio activity is happening in the area. Say there's a big airport, you can have a big problem with microwave. That's just a noise issue. Anyway, C-band was used to make a digital elevation model. So what we have is the L-band data, and if you were just taking a quick look of the data over the landslide, based on the satellites that were available at the time, you wouldn't get very much. You would get a lot of these holes, all this black stuff, these are holes, and these are caused by the fact that you have a rugged terrain, so you can have instant energy on this rugged terrain and none of it coming back to you because you're in the shadow of a mountain. So rugged terrain is a real problem for radar, but in this case, we're able to use it. And I'll talk to you a little bit about that. So this would be if you just had the simple satellite systems that were available at the time in 2000. If you had the more advanced systems that are becoming available now, actually in November of 2006, this kind of satellite data would be free, would be available. You can start to see more information. These black areas, there's no getting around them. You're not going to get any information out of there because it's called shadowing. It's got a lovely jargon term. But you start to see the shape of the Saoling landslide, the rivers, a few rivers over here, and this is generally because of the polarimetry. So the polarimetry is showing you now the difference between bare surfaces and vegetation. So if you were doing a quick look to say, oh my goodness, where should I put the relief efforts, where should I focus everything, you would probably say, let's go right there, and you'd be right. So that's a good thing. Now, I came up with a classification scheme based on using those scattering mechanism and entropy decomposition techniques, and I tried to compare them with the best available visible data at the time and basic radar data that was available at the time. This here is a SAR classification. So I'll just take you through quickly. So this is letter A is a SAR classification. B is just synthetic aperture radar. This is a radar classification based on the black and white image you just saw before. This here is using RGB, the visible and infrared parts of the spectrum. So if you had clouds, you wouldn't be able to see this one. And this is the Indian remote sensing panchromatic band, which means it's all the visible into one, plus a little bit of infrared. Right, and these two would be difficult if you didn't have radar, because the clouds could get in the way if you were dealing with an operational issue. But if you don't have to, you know, if you don't have to worry about it, clearly these are superior. Okay, the visible are really excellent. So if you were thinking about dealing with a major disaster in an arid zone that didn't have a major weather event recently, this would be a really great way of doing it. But the good news is that radar is just as good if you have proper sensors. And the purple corresponds to the purple, the green corresponds to the green. Some of these purple returns here indicating bare surface scattering are for water and make things a little bit difficult to discern. But in general, this was a way that had been first proven that for disaster mapping, you could use these kinds of techniques. And you can get even better. I hooked up with one of my colleagues down at NRL, and he had this really excellent filtering algorithm, Professor Jensen Lee. And he was able to take the data that we had looked at for the Salling landslide and come up with a nearly true color, if you believe it, a better representation of the landslide surface. And you get shades of brown where there's surface scattering, shades of green where there's volume scattering or forest cover, and shades of blue where you have water. And over here, this double bounce, these are corner reflections. So this is urban developments. So urban developments in this case means small houses. But you do have, you can distinguish between some of these more useful representations of what's happening on the ground. So if you do it for one disaster, can you do it for other disasters? And the answer is yes, because this is a talk that deals with landslides, volcanoes, and wildfires, so I already gave it away. But let's take a look at the results from Mountain Volcano. So the first result was for the Chichi earthquake, so that was the PACRIM 2 mission, and this is the PACRIM, the initial PACRIM, they didn't call it one, this is the initial PACRIM mission in 1996, and this mission had the, I guess the good fortune is one way of putting it, of flying over this tiny little island, Manam Island, Papua New Guinea, as it was experiencing eruption. So the images that I'm going to show you are of Manam Volcano as it is erupting, and it gives you an idea of how operationally what this radar instrument could be looking at and helping you to understand. And let me just give you a better idea. So this schematic is of Manam Volcano. You see it has perfect X radial valleys coming out of the main crater, and it's one of the most active volcanoes in the Pacific Rim. Okay, so in 1995, one of my colleagues went and took some photos of the region, and this is Nir Hammond's image of a lava flow. I guess this was the 1994 lava flow in the Southeast Valley. Let me just give you, Southeast Valley is right over here. The Northeast Valley was also erupting at the time. And Southeast Valley lava flow, you could see you've got surface reflection from this a'a flow. A'a, a'a, it's a great Hawaiian word that means that as you're stepping on it, you're saying a'a. That hurts. And it's true. Never been to Hawaii and tried to walk on a lava flow. It's really difficult. It can really tear up your hiking boots. And then over here, you've got your vegetation, and there you go. So there's our cartoon that represents what's happening, and we've discussed how we can see revegetation and deforestation, resurfacing after an event. And a good thing about the PACRIM mission is that it was also collecting the C-band data, which is used to make digital elevation models. And this is a nicely exaggerated, but not too much. I think this is just a 2x exaggeration of the cone. So it's a very steep cone. And you can see the same classification scheme that we used for the Salling landslide, where the green is the forest, purple is the bare surface, and we were able to tweak our algorithm to show that water is blue. So this is getting a little bit better. And what's happening here is that we're seeing this new New volcano. New volcanic flow. Right here. New volcano. New volcanic flow. And if we zoom in a little bit, this is all radar data that was acquired in 1996. And what we have here is that green and purple representation of the forest cover and the lava flow. And if we look at it in three different bands, so this is a combination of P is red, L is green, and C is blue, and it gives us the gradation of the different, basically the different level scales of revegetation. So you're in a tropical or humid environment, and the revegetation is extremely rapid. And that's one way that you can map volcanic flows very easily, is if you're in an area that's revegetated a lot, and you create more volume scattering over time. So looking at the degrees to which you have volume scattering can be very useful in mapping lava flows. And it's actually a technique that I used to study the Virunga volcanic chain in Rwanda a few years ago, because the revegetation there is extremely rapid. Okay, so we were able to take a look at the revegetation of Monum volcano and the devegetation based on lava flows, the Chichi earthquake in Taiwan disaster, and now we can take a look at a more local disaster. So we're leaving the Pac Rim, and now we're just tasking the DC-8 AIRSAR for our own uses. And what we're doing is we're going to try and understand and rehabilitate the altered landscape. So as we all know, wildfires severely alter the landscape. Sometimes it's more severe than others. What happened in 2002 is that the Rodeo Chudesky was very severe. It was caused by arson. There were actually two wildfires, the Rodeo wildfire and the Chudesky wildfire. And they coalesced, I think it was just a couple weeks after they were both ignited, and they became a very large wildfire in eastern central Arizona, and it covered a good amount of Indian Reservation, Apache Sitgreaves Forest, and burned 500,000 acres. So this is some of the aerial photography, just taken hanging out of a plane in C&D, of the burn scar. And you can see that there was logging in the area. That's why you have these nice square patterns. And even without the logging, you would have had a very severe fire. And what you have is just some of the trees are standing, and most of them are just poles remaining after the fact. You can see a very, very bare surface. And here, it just missed this area where people are living. And this is another representation of the area, using remote sensing and just showing you who owned different parts of the area. So this is a Landsat 743, which is an infrared, visible green, and visible red. And this is what is the standard use of Landsat data, or Landsat is a visible and infrared instrument, and it's practically free. It's being run by NASA, but you can get this kind of data very rapidly if you're lucky. So it's on a revisit time of, I think, every couple of weeks. And in this case, there was a nice image just a little bit after the last fire was extinguished. You can see there are clouds in the upper left-hand corner of the burn scar. So this is a pretty large burn scar. What I wanted to do was see if the radar information over this area could give people who are involved in the relief efforts a better idea of where the big problems were. So where your stands of trees were remaining, where your soil was totally bare and now exposed to potential rains. They do get monsoons in this region, albeit much less frequently than in Asia. Okay, so this is what the burn area evaluation and rehabilitation team used. This is the same Landsat image, and what they did is they tried to difference the before and after scenes of where the burn scar was and what the severity is. And as you can see from this, you're really just getting two colors. You're getting white and you're getting gray. So you're not getting that intra-burn variability. And radar up to this point really was only getting that same binary look of a particular region that had been experienced a burn. So this is the Cave Creek, Arizona burn scar. And again, you have that binary green and not green. So it just gives you the perimeter and location, the aerial extent, but it's not giving you any further information on where you need to direct your relief efforts or your recovery efforts. So of course, we try to get into some of this more more fancy decomposition of the radar, the scattering vector jargon. Basically, you're doing an analysis and a manipulation of the radar data a little bit differently to try to tease out the scattering mechanisms. So this is what alpha is, scattering mechanism, and different contributions. And instead of just looking at one band, it's a multi-frequency look. So you're seeing the scales, you're seeing the scattering mechanisms at these three different scales. So L band is, of course, the scale of about a foot. C band, scale of a couple inches. And P band is a scale of a couple of feet. So what this is showing you is the structure remaining in the forest at those scales of a couple inches, just a foot and a couple of feet. So that's actually almost perfect for pine trees. Pine trees, pine needles, pine branches, pine trunks. So in a ponderosa pine forest, which is exactly what burned during this event, you can see a good amount of variability when you have a variable burn. Okay. So if we were looking at this, in a healthy forest system, it would be more difficult because the canopy would be more dense. Canopy being just the density of needles and trunks and branches. Okay. So what this really boils down to is now we have what's called SAR-based burn severity. And you get green and cyan for intact needles, branches, and trunks. There might have been a ground fire that came through, and there might be low-lying vegetation and trunks, but basically these are regions that weren't touched. So all this green stuff here is pretty nice and untouched. Then the purple areas are areas where you have needles are absent, trunks and branches are present. And then the yellow that you see sort of scattered around are rough surfaces, so regions where you might have odd bouncing around and odd reception of microwaves because of topography. So probably also have no trunks or low-lying vegetation, but this is where things are a little bit sketchier in the yellow areas. And that basically sums up what the different disasters are that you can cover. But there is more. Just a few more minutes. Future directions of what might happen if we launch more satellites and push the science a little bit further. So I just want to talk to you about that very quickly. But maybe we should... No, actually, let's do a few questions at the very end. These are two scientific missions right here. So airplanes and UAVs, I think, are really going to be the future for disaster mapping if you want to get into recovery and relief efforts. If you have a fleet of, say, UAVs, which are unmanned autonomous vehicles, you can drive by remote control from wherever you are, say, just like in the Iraq War where you have people in Nevada who are flying Predators and other UAVs around Iraq, you can do the same thing with disaster mapping and go to places that aren't very accessible, but you can take very good images of. And that's what this image is right here. This is a NOAA UAV, and it's equipped with a number of different remote sensing sensors. None of them are in the microwave region of the spectrum, at least not actively, but it's used for scientific collection of data. And over here, this is the DC-8 that I was talking to you about that has all the AirSAR instruments. It's actually no longer in use, but when it was in use, it had the state-of-the-art of radar instruments on it. And the potential is there to have such a fleet scattered around the world available at a moment's notice to do exactly what we need it to do and collect data. And I'm not just saying this for radar data. I'm saying for any type of remote sensing. And I think it does exist on some level, but it's more in terms of, you sort of call up your friend and you say, oh, did you hear that there's this disaster? Can you take care of it? It's not as formal as it potentially could be. Oh, good. The movie is running. I was worried we didn't have a file. We can get much more interesting information if we consider a third dimension. So I've talked to you a little bit about scattering mechanisms and how a house is different from a tree. And you can see that a house is different from a tree under a number of different circumstances. You don't need radar to do it. But you could certainly use the different potentials of radar to find where is the scattering center. So how big is your object? How dense is your object? Where is most of the information located in that object? And radar, like we said, it's ranging. So it's radio detection and ranging. So you're actually finding, you're using microwaves to range to something. So you're getting the distance. So that's how we get digital elevation models. Oftentimes, you can get digital elevation models that way. So if we combine a mission that does interferometry that creates digital elevation models with polarimetry that takes the scattering mechanisms, you can do just what this group did in Germany, which is you see a tree and you can figure out its scattering center. And this is what a vertical slice would look like through on top of the surface. So you can start to imagine what the potentials could be if you're doing this tomography of the surface. And that's also what's being touted down here. So you see how there are all these little like spikes and cones sticking out of the surface here. This is an animated flight over the Thetford Forest. And this elevation model is generated from an X-band interferometric DEM. And if we had color data that represented the type of scattering mechanism, we could get better information about the structure of what's actually on top of the Earth. So this is definitely not a bare Earth representation, because there's something interesting happening on top of the Earth that we can start to discern. Okay. So I'm certainly not the only one who's interested in radar and remote sensing and what it can do for us. All these different countries and the EU think that it's pretty important too. There are a number of current and newly launched satellites. Envisat was launched in 2002, and ALOS Pulsar by the Japanese was launched just this past November. TerraSAR X is an X-band satellite. It's planned to be launched as of yesterday. It was supposed to be launched next week, but as of today, it's going to be launched in May. So that's kind of the way it's been going over the past year and a half. And we're hoping it's going to be launched next May. And RadarSat 2 is another satellite that there's planned for a launch of that in the summer. So let me show you what they look like. I always call this image of Envisat the flying bus. As it does, doesn't it look like a flying bus? Yeah, the flying bus. And these are its antennas and its solar panel. So it's a C-band instrument, so order of inches. And it's alternating polarization, which means it doesn't have the full polarimetry to take out the scattering mechanisms and figure out exactly what's causing all this really interesting information. But it gets really close. And it also has interferometry. And it's at its five-year anniversary just last month. So that's the end of its proposed lifetime, but it's been doing pretty well. So go Envisat. Yeah, I have to keep going. Okay. And then there's the ALOS Pulsar, which was... like I said, it was launched in 2006, and this is a slightly different kind of system. It's L-band, fully polarimetric, and it's got interferometry, and this is just an artist's rendition of what it would look like as it's imaging Japan, and it's another very cool instrument. L-band, which means it's really great for vegetation, so an idea is that this could be used for biomass mapping. Pretty neat. Then there's the TerraSAR X, and this is an X-band instrument, so it's even smaller wavelength than the C-band. And the potential there is that if you have a smaller wavelength, you can get a finer resolution, a spatial resolution. So instead of looking at things with the ARSAR instrument, which is actually about 5 meter resolution, now we're getting down to the meter scale and centimeter scale. So really, really detailed observations of the Earth. It's fully polarimetric in X-band, and it's also got that tomography mode. So for a scientist like myself, it's like candy. But again, hasn't been launched yet. We've got one more month. We're hoping that that's going to launch soon. And these are all satellites. So they're not operational for disasters. They are experimental. The idea is generally, let's go up there and let's get information and see how we can move this into a commercial product and move this into a useful product. And in some cases, it is operational for, say, biomass studies, which people use for carbon budgeting, carbon sequestration, interest in that kind of thing. But they're satellites, so they do have certain limitations. The final one I'm going to show you is the RADARSAT 2. And again, this one is being, we hope it's being launched in the summer of 2007. C-band, so it's a smaller wavelength, full polarimetry with interferometry, and it could be a very useful instrument also by the Canadians. And with that, I'd like to acknowledge my colleagues who helped me with this research and lots of very useful input. And I would be happy to, address any questions that you might have or comments. Thank you so much for your attention.